Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bjorkman, Judge Smith, Judge Sleater, the Honorable Louise Dovery Bjorkman presiding.
Good morning. Please be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is Thursday, April 25th, 2024. The first matter on our calendar for oral argument is State of Minnesota versus Johnny Lerma. Counsel, I know you are well aware of our procedures. I'll just remind you that you will each have 15 minutes to present your argument. Counsel for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. It's important that you state your name and identify the party you represent because we are making an audio recording of this session, and that is the only recording that is permitted. With that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Paul Maravilli. I represent the appellant in this case, Mr. Johnny Lerma. Two claims being brought in this appeal are ones of structural error and a double jeopardy claim. If I may begin with the structural error aspect of my argument, I would start that by asserting that I'm relying essentially on the principle established in the Mims decision from our Supreme Court in 1975, which was the principle of which was affirmed in the Everson decision in 08, that it essentially can be summed up that a judge's interference with a jury's decision-making process is grounds for structural error. And if I may cite the specific grounds I'm claiming that structural error on here, that the jury was spontaneously, ad hoc, issued instructions on the meaning and effect of a mistrial without consulting either counsel. Two, the jury was informed that should they not be able to decide it, a different jury would take care of it. And three, that the effect of these wound up influencing and prolonging the jury's deliberations, which was contrary to the order they had already been given to stop deliberating. They went back in and changed from 3 unanimous to 5 deadlock, which clearly influenced the decision-making process. Thus, I cite those as the grounds for a finding of structural error here.
Do any of the cases you've relied on in your structural error argument present the situation we have here where there were was actually a mistrial declared?
I don't think that, you know, I think the two I've cited are Mims and Moore. And I don't believe that, you know, Mims was based on a mistrial finding or order. It was just based on improper instructions to the jury. And I see that the ultimate decision on the mistrial is actually a separate issue. What I would focus more on is the effect of the instructions on the jury's decision-making process.
But hasn't the structural error instruction kind of focused on the instruction to a jury to, you must deliberate, you must reach a result? I mean, that's sort of the opposite of what we have in this case.
Well, it has not always been that. I've cited the Kelly case from 94 as an example of where the judge didn't even go into the jury room. He just sent instructions saying, continue deliberating. It was not an Allen charge. It was not, you must. And that was grounds for reversal, albeit on a harmless error standard, because there were no new legal instructions.
And counsel, that wasn't the concern there, too, without counsel's input.
Yes, that was also part of it, that as Kelly wound up holding, there was no chance for defense counsel to suggest a suitable course of action, such as rereading the instruction, which is precisely what happened in the State v. Crow case that I cited, where they held there was no error because the jury came in with basically the same scenario, the same question. What will the effect of a not guilty verdict on one charge have on the other offenses? The court consulted with both counsel before just rereading the instruction. If there is one thing that's become clear to me canvassing all of this case law, it's that when judges step outside the instructions, you know, they risk interference with the jury's decision-making process. And this is the point that I most want to emphasize here, because obviously we don't know what the jurors said to themselves, but the record itself demonstrates that their decision-making process was interfered with. They come back in, say they're unanimous on three, hung on two. But then the questions happened. Well, what is a mistrial? What's the effect? Again, leaving apart the issue that was ordered.
But then isn't the real concern the instruction about whether it was final or not, and whether, in fact, a juror could change his or her mind?
Yes, because, in a sense, the district court contradicted itself by having first told them, you're done deliberating, but then they asked, well, can we go back and change? And they said, and he said, yes. And then the question about, well, if we're hung on charges, who decides it, us? And he says, a different jury.
Counsel, can I... You use the phrase landscape of cases, and you certainly did paint a landscape, both of state and federal cases. But I jotted down three points from each of those, any one of those cases that doesn't seem to be present or a distinction from our case. And I just want you to respond to that. And the three I come up with is that the record here is clear that your client and counsel were a part of all the discussions and all meetings. There was no verdict yet reached at the time these questions you were just referring to. And finally, maybe most importantly, your client consented to a mistrial. And when I look at all those cases, that seems each one of those, or maybe multiple of those, were part of the problem that was being addressed. But yet, none of that, because of those three points here, I guess my big question is, am I looking at it wrong by pointing out those three things that seem to be existing here that were either missing or complicated in those other cases that you cite?
I would respectfully disagree with your conclusions, but quickly note...
Which conclusions are you disagreeing with?
All three of them. Well, but I'll just quickly note that, yes, this particular scenario is not exactly reflected in any of the cases I've cited. I'm relying more on the principle of interference with the decision-making process. But defense counsel and the prosecutor were not consulted. There was no discussion prior to...
Well, there was significant discussion, was there not, before the jury came in about the fact that one of the jurors had a spouse who had COVID tested positive. And so the judge and counsel met in chambers, and then they came out, and then there was a discussion about what occurred in chambers, and the judge had decided we're going to do a mistrial and asked both counsel to confirm, and there was no response.
Sorry, Your Honor, that isn't what was said when they first came out. The judge said he didn't know what he was going to do because he didn't know whether the jury had reached verdicts or not.
Well, right. But what I'm getting at is I understand the judge didn't know because the night before they had said they didn't have a verdict on any counts, and then he was going to inquire to see if there was any. The point being is on any counts for which they had a verdict, which had not yet been reached, he was going to accept those, and on any counts that were not, that there he would consider it a mistrial. Is that not accurate in terms of...
No, that does sum up the record, but okay. It doesn't deal with the fact, it doesn't address the fact of the instructions that he then gave sua sponte when the jury came out and announced their three unanimous, two deadlock.
You're referring to his answer to the questions of both the foreperson
yes.
and the... Now, you refer to those as instructions...
Yes, I do, sir.
Okay, I understand that. I question that applicability in the sense of instructions from these case law where they had a question during deliberations. But let me ask this. Is there anything that the judge said that was contrary to law?
Contrary to the holding of the Martin case, yes. So in that sense, contrary to the law. The Supreme Court in Martin in 1975... This was the case where the Supreme Court adopted the ABA standards for jury instructions, and their concluding sentence was, most important, the jury must not be told that another jury can decide the case if they deadlock.
So that was part of the Allen charge that they reversed, correct?
Yes,
no longer
in Martin.
Right.
But I'm just focusing on that aspect of the standards that Martin adopted and that were then applied just a few months later in Mims.
But the context of that is when a jury says we are hung or we can't make a decision, the Supreme Court said it would be improper to force them to, that's the Allen instruction, to continue deliberating such that you are doing your civic duty. Is that?
But what you just said is exactly what happened here. The jury came out and announced they were hung on two counts. Then they asked, well, if it's a mistrial, do we decide it or does another jury decide it? And the judge told them a different jury, which is exactly what the Martin court said was the most important thing not to tell them.
Isn't the whole point, though, of that Martin decision and then the point of no longer using the Allen instruction is not to suggest to them that a non-verdict is not a proper ending? Here, the judge had already determined on any counts that were had not been decided or unanimously decided was going to be a mistrial. So how was the jury coerced in this case that would be contrary to what Martin?
I have not said that they were coerced, Your Honor.
But isn't that what Martin is all about and the ending of the Allen charge?
The Martin case I'm citing for the principle of law that they espoused related to the jury instruction standard from the ABA, that the most important thing is not to tell them another jury will decide the case. The principles of law I'm relying on,
in order,
more specifically,
to finish that, though, in order not to coerce them into thinking that that's not an option, correct?
Yes.
Okay. How did that happen here?
Because they asked, will a different jury decide the case? And they asked, will it be us or a different? And he said a different jury would decide it.
But don't we have to look at the broader context, which is that the judge has already told this jury, you're done. No more deliberations here.
I mean, yes, but they weren't done.
Well, they were done.
They were not. They went back.
They hadn't signed a verdict,
they
right?
They spent 20 minutes. The judge had to order them to come back. They went and they continued deliberating. And
well, why do we assume that? We assume that juries follow instructions. And this court made it very clear, you're not deliberating. What I'm going to have you do is go back in and sign the verdicts. Make
Your
sure
Honor,
you poll the jurors and sign the verdicts.
They did not follow those instructions.
How do we know that? How do we know they didn't have breaks for the restroom during this process?
Your Honor, they came back unanimous on three, deadlocked on two. They retired for 20 minutes and came back deadlocked on all five. That is further deliberation. They deliberated and decided, no, we're going to be split on all five. That's deliberation. It's right there in the record. So they didn't follow the instructions. They continued deliberating, which I'm going to just try to throw in here, is an indication that the judge's opinion about what was the manifest necessity for the mistrial here, that someone was COVID exposed, the jury obviously didn't care about that because they went and sat huddled together for 20 minutes changing their votes.
I thought they went into an adjacent courtroom that had been spaced out.
They didn't
have to be in the confines of the jury room anymore.
The concern the court identified was all of them being in the same room wasn't going to happen. The jury wasn't worried about that. In any event, on that issue of whether it was a manifest necessity, there's no law to support that. The only case that I could find that dealt with illness being a source for a manifest necessity was Yeboah, and that's where someone had actually contracted an illness. This exposed juror had had two negative tests, and I need to address the issue of the other points that you made, Your Honor. The defense did not consent to the mischarge here. The only reference to it was when, as soon as the judge said that he was waiting to see what the jury was going to say and he would order a mistrial if they were deadlocked on any counts, Mr. Lerma told his lawyer to say, I want a mistrial. The judge refused to accept it. He said that's premature. After that, the colloquy that kept happening between defense counsel and the district court indicated that the defense attorney could barely grasp what was happening or what was going on. He said, what if they come back changed? And, you know, the judge just kept answering questions, but he didn't know. But as far as whether there was consent, I'm going to rely mostly on the Olson case from this court in 2000, where a similar thing unfolded in that a mistrial was ordered based on a finding of manifest necessity by the judge who said that the defendant had been unreasonably dilatory in deciding his issue of representation. He came back, I don't know how many weeks later, and made the mistrial motion then. The Olson court cited Arizona v. Washington for saying that under circumstances like that, where there's fast-moving parts going on, the proper outcome was done in Arizona v. Washington, where counsel was given time to formulate their objections to the mistrial, versus in Olson, where he was not. I'm also relying on the fact that
how counsel, in our court's Hunter decision, there was no explicit statement on a record of consent like there was here. I know you dispute that, but it's undisputed that it was said on the record. But moreover, in Hunter, focused solely on implied consent and spent a lot of time talking about the meetings and chambers, which,
that
again, we had here in consultation, and yet multiple times, including after the time the jury then was sent to the adjacent courtroom, your client attorney was asked, is there any objection or comments? And other than the colloquy you're just referring to, there was no objection to what was being done. So my question is this, is there any case law that you're aware of that has some form of a temporal requirement of when the consent is given, and or why would implied consent not be present from this record?
Well, first I need to distinguish Hunter because, see, the in-chamber discussion that happened here was one time and it was preliminary. They didn't know what was going to happen. The judge had not indicated what he could do. In Hunter, it was the opposite. The judge was already deciding to order a mistrial, and they had in-chambers discussions about the decision to order a mistrial. That wasn't here because the judge didn't know what he was going to do yet. I mean, he needed to know whether the jury was going to come back, whether they were hung on any or all counts. And I'm relying on Olson and Hunter because they both state that consent does not have to be explicit. It must be examined under the circumstances. And what I must do here is point out that under Olson, this is the same kind of situation combined with the fact that post-trial motions are permitted when the objections are based on jury instructions, which is what was at issue here, Rule 2603, Subdivision 19. I'm out of time.
You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I am Assistant Hennepin County Attorney Adam Petras, and I represent the respondent in this matter, the state of Minnesota. In this appeal, to borrow your words, Judge Bjorkman, it's critical to place Judge Qualm's comments to the jury on the third day of deliberations into their broader, proper context. That day, the defense asked for a, quote, complete mistrial. It's page 508 to 509 of the trial transcript, end quote. On behalf of Mr. Lerma, I discussed the circumstances with him, and he wants me to ask for a complete mistrial on the entire case.
And that's before, the foreperson had said, we have an agreement as to three of the five counts.
That is what the foreperson said. There was a unanimous verdict. To be quite honest, the foreperson was mistaken because no verdict form had been signed.
No, but when you talk about defense counsel saying we want a mistrial, my client wants a mistrial, that was before the foreperson had come back in, right?
Let's read what goes on right after that comment is made on page 508-509. So after the statement, he wants me to ask for a complete mistrial on the entire case. Judge Qualm says, okay, and it's a request that depending on what their process or status is, it may be moot. It may be there's no verdict on any counts in which I'll just declare a mistrial. If they have reached verdicts on some counts, I will take those verdicts over Mr. Lerma's objection. I think it's within my discretion to do that. Appellant's counsel then says, thank you. Judge Qualm then asks, anything else to note before we bring the jury in? Appellant's counsel responds, no. He's standing by the position that appellant, at least in the trial court setting, wanted a complete mistrial. And that brings me back to the broader context, because Judge Qualm ultimately ordered exactly what appellant requested. He wanted a mistrial granted right then and there. Of course, I mean, there took a little time before they got to that point in trial court. But that is essentially exactly what happened. Once the jury re-enters the courtroom, it became clear that although the jury had originally thought they had reached a unanimous verdict on three of those five offenses, and I shouldn't say the jury at this point, I should say just the foreperson, they actually had not completed a verdict form on any of those three offenses because no verdict had actually been, nothing had been signed, nothing had been formalized, which is what law, Minnesota Statute 631.17 requires.
Counsel, can you explain to me, does it matter, was there an instruction not to deliberate? Does it matter if they did? Does the 20 minutes matter? How does the idea of additional deliberation factor in, if at all?
I don't believe there was an additional deliberation. I understand.
Does it matter if there had been? Assuming
for the purposes of your question,
yes.
I don't think it does. No.
And can you speak to that? Why?
Sure. I mean, ultimately, under rules of criminal procedure, the judge has the authority to provide supplemental instruction. It was made in open court and it was accurate. There's no dispute that what he said was accurate under the law, under what a hung jury actually is. And so by giving
I think your opponent would take issue with that statement. I think the argument from appellant is, in fact, that wasn't accurate because it suggested that they had to reach a particular verdict.
I actually will push back on that, Judge Bjorkman, because I don't believe that I hear opposing counsel saying what Judge Quam told the jury was inaccurate as a statement of law. What I hear opposing counsel saying is under the last sentence of the Supreme Court's 1973 decision in Martin, it was improper for him to give that accurate statement of law. And I believe there's a distinction between those two things.
Okay.
And I can address what actually was said in Martin. First off, this court, in its own controlling authority, Fidel, a 1990 presidential decision that I cite in my brief, said, quote, dovetailing what Judge Sleeter was mentioning before, that the rationale of Martin is to preclude a trial court from intruding into the jury's deliberations and from coercing a minority among a deadlock jury to enter into a unanimous verdict. Martin rejected an Allen charge, that dynamite charge. It spells out in great detail and painting the landscape of the law back at that time in the early 1970s. And that last sentence in Martin refers to a portion of an Allen or a dynamite charge in which a judge would tell a jury in the context of urging those in the minority to reevaluate their position and agree with the majority to understand that they don't need to reach, if they don't reach a unanimous verdict, a different jury will have to reach one. That's why the current jury should just reach one now. That is the essence of the Allen charge. And so suggesting that some other jury will have to discharge the responsibility, which the first jury failed to fulfill, that last sentence of Martin, that was used to motivate that first current jury to force themselves in a unanimous verdict. And Judge Bjorkman, I heard you before pointing out that's obviously not what Judge Quam did in this case. In this case, in fact, Judge Quam did the opposite. First off, he did not give the jury an Allen charge, and he did not urge those in the minority on the undecided verdicts, or those who just decided to change their mind from the claimed unanimous decision earlier, to reevaluate. And that is that last sentence of Martin needs to be read in the broader context of what Martin, as a precedential landscape-changing decision, actually meant.
Mr. Petras, was there an opportunity, and if so, point out, you can tell me when it was, for appellant to undo his request for a complete mistrial?
Judge Sleeter, you were a trial judge for many years. You know that when you're in a courtroom and there's trial lawyers there, they always have the opportunity to object. That's the whole nature of a trial. It's not like after every single question that a lawyer asks, the judge stops things, looks at the opposing counsel and says, do you have an objection to that? You need to speak up.
So at what point would you say on this particular record should appellant have spoke up to undo that request?
There are numerous times. I don't recall off the top of my head. I know the record will speak for itself whether which of the two jurors that ultimately asked what a hung jury is to Judge Quam. But after both times when that was asked, one juror asked it, Judge Quam gave an answer, then another juror asked essentially the same question, and Judge Quam repeated his answer. After the question was asked, after the question was answered the first time, after the question was asked the second time, after the question was answered the second time, those were all opportunities for appellant's trial counsel to speak up and voice an objection to what was being said at that time. And I point out in my brief, and I'll reiterate right here, there is no allegation on appeal that appellant's trial counsel was somehow ineffective for not doing that, or it was wrong in any way for him not to speak up. So those were all opportunities at which that objection could have been levied. And this court's decision in Hunter, I know that was discussed earlier too, procedurally going back to one of your earlier questions, Judge Bjorkman, about the case law that's cited, and do any of them involve non-convictions? Do any of them involve the ordering of a mistrial? Hunter, 2012, controlling decision of this court, does exactly that. Procedurally is the most similar to what we're looking at here. And I will note that in Judge Ross's decision in Hunter, you know, even though procedurally, after the mistrial was ordered, a motion for, you know, a motion to dismiss the charge on double the jeopardy grounds was filed, you know, complaining about what happened at that trial, and that was litigated just like it was here, Judge Ross pointed to the comments that were made contemporaneously with the actual trial and when the mistrial was ordered, pointing at the positions that appellant took at that time as being very kind of compelling and persuasive about how he actually felt about the issue. And I want to return to a theme that I was intended to get at the outset. And that, I mean, to be very frank with this panel, it kind of feels like a gotcha. Appellant asked for a complete mistrial. And Judge Qualm, although admittedly he was initially resistant to that request, as I just read from the record at page 509 of the transcript, he ultimately did exactly what appellant asked for. And now, because of what Judge Qualm said to the jury after Judge Qualm and everyone else believed the jury was done deliberating, appellant is now claiming that the mistrial he asked for should actually be barred from happening. And that is just frankly not consistent with fairness and justice. And Judge Smith, I will say that the position I'm taking right now is different than the assumption I made before in response to your question, because the state's position is that there was no deliberation consistent with Judge Bjorkman's questions to opposing counsel during the time when the foreperson thought that there was unanimous verdict. Clearly, because the verdict forms did not sign, they had not reached that decision formally, which is how Minnesota law treats the reaching of a verdict. It doesn't.
What did they do for 20 minutes then? I mean, appellant's counsel said the record itself demonstrates that they did, even if they were told not to, go back and continue their deliberations after, you know, at a time in which the district court had already decided that was not appropriate.
They essentially did what law already requires, which was poll themselves as opposed to being polled by the judge. The law expressly provides that jury can be polled after its verdict is read in court. And when the jury is polled, if an individual juror expresses disagreement with that announced verdict, the verdict is not unanimous and is not final. And that's essentially what happened in this case. It's just that rather than the polling happening when it traditionally happens, you know, when it's traditionally documented in the record, when it's read in open court, it happened one step earlier when the jury itself was preparing to sign the verdict forms that the foreperson thought, mistakenly, everyone had agreed to. Sorry. And if polling... Oh, go ahead, Judge Smith.
Well, I was just... And maybe this is better, and I would appreciate it on rebuttal. I'm just trying to figure out, in the asserted errors by the appellant, where does the fact of a the alleged fact of a potential inferring that there was deliberation even fit in with where the errors are alleged? That's what I'm trying to figure out. Analytically, if they did or didn't, how does that change the, oh, there were instructions given without consultation and that was structural error, or a mistrial shouldn't have?
I'm not sure if I track your question.
I'm trying to figure out analytically if, in fact, like we're trying, like the suggestion is, oh, we should infer there is deliberation from 20 minutes, which leave aside the problems about that. I'm trying to figure out where even the answer to that question fits in the two asserted errors analytically. If they did or didn't deliberate, where does that create error by the district court?
Well, I don't think it does.
And that's what I'm not, and I'll hear from that on rebuttal. I'm not quite seeing how it fits in.
I'm with you that I don't see it being there. And I Minnesota Statute 631.17 that I cited before, I understand the precedent that talks about rules of procedure taking precedent over statutes that describe judicial procedure. But then I would point this court to Minnesota Rule 26.03, Subdivision 20, Clause 5, which discusses the act of polling. Again, before the form is signed, everyone needs to assent to it. And it sounds like there had been deliberations that led the foreperson to believe that there was unanimous verdict on three of the five offenses.
The prior day between, 12:30 and 4:30, there had been a question right at 12:30 the day before about what's our time frame if we can't reach agreement, and then they deliberated the rest of that day.
Right. There were two questions the previous day. There was one about
one in the morning,
more substantive law, and then there was one about what happens if we can't reach an agreement. And so, yes, there in the time that remained and the during the afternoon of the second day of deliberations is when the foreperson, based on those deliberations, was led to believe, oh, we've decided three of them. But ultimately, when it came time to poll or to vote or to sign the verdict form. And that's what announces the actual verdict. It's not the foreperson coming into the courtroom and saying, this is what we decide unanimously. It's the judge or the judge's clerk reading the verdict form that represents the jury's decision, whether it be unanimous or not. And that is what did not exist. So the foreperson saying that we've reached a unanimous verdict was frankly inaccurate based on how the law describes a verdict, because the law describes a verdict as that written form that is ultimately read in open court.
So then why doesn't the district court's instruction or answer to a question that delves into the some other jury will have to decide this if you don't. Why didn't that put some pressure that was inappropriate on this jury?
Because I guess the pressure that I see in case law, similar to some of the questions that were asked earlier, is about deciding something even if it's against how individual jurors as part of this group of 12 people feel about a particular case.
And so you're saying what happened here would be the opposite of pressuring a jury to reach a decision.
Judge Qualm was quite plainly saying that there is no pressure to decide a verdict. Again, in the context of having just been told minutes earlier, or less than a half an hour, that the position that one of the parties had taken, appellant, was that he wanted a complete mistrial. Judge Qualm was saying that, yes, that would be a possibility. What appellant has just asked me to order in this case. He obviously didn't tell that part to the jury, but he did accurately say what would happen without pressuring them into making a decision. And that's what the law repeatedly cautions against, is pressuring jurors to make a decision that they don't agree with and they're not comfortable with. That's the reason that the Allen charge was disregarded. That's the reason for the instructions as they are in place today. And that is completely consistent with ultimately how Judge Qualm approach this trial. I see I have 23 seconds left. I'm happy to entertain any additional questions.
One quick question, Mr. Petras. On the day before question, the second group of questions, they used the phrase, I think the quote was, what do we do if we can't reach a verdict on all counts? So would it be safe to say that the judge and the parties had some inkling that they might have a verdict on some but not all the counts?
Judge Bjorkman, I'm out of time. May I answer Judge Sleeter's question? Thank you. Judge Sleeter, I think that would be a fair assumption. I think that's probably what led Judge Qualm to be initially hesitant to the request for a complete mistrial on the entire case or on all counts, is because there had been some indication, if you read that particular line in the transcript closely, being a trial judge, you know that sometimes, how it's read by us in a transcript later is not necessarily how it feels or it's heard in a courtroom. But there was some indication that there had been agreement on some of the counts, which is probably what led the foreperson to think that there had been agreement on some of the counts too, because that question on the second day of trial was almost certainly written by the foreperson.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Maravilla, you have the last word.
Thank you, and I hope I can address the questions I heard being raised here. The most significant fact that I think should be addressed here that I did not get a chance to address before was the notion that the preliminary premature request for a mistrial somehow stuck. I'm relying on the judge's own words saying that that's premature, we don't know what they're going to do yet, which distinguishes this case from Hunter, where, in looking at my brief, on the second day they knew exactly what the jury was hung on and what they weren't, and they had discussions about it in chambers. That didn't happen here until after the jury had already come into the courtroom. But I'm going to be relying on the district court's comments at page 520 of the transcripts, when, as soon as he ordered the mistrial, he used the words, let me get back to the page. At this point, should just set an OM. You guys can take inventory of where you're at, where you want to go. I'm not going to ask for any decisions at this point. Now, a respondent has argued that that was merely in reference to a scheduling thing, which this statement does not convey, especially in light of everything that had just transpired, all of the questions that the defense attorney asked, trying to understand what was going on, how it could have gone from two deadlock to five deadlock. The only reasonable inference to be taken from this is that the judge was going to allow any objections to what happened at a later date, which case law permits. Olson, if nothing else, permits the bringing of a mistrial based on Arizona objection, based on Arizona v. Washington, saying that this is something that defense counsel or a defendant representing himself should have the time to think about before they answer. Now, the second thing that came up was, how can it just be assumed that 20 minutes was deliberating? I respectfully submit, Your Honor, that it does not take 20 minutes to sign verdict forms.
Okay, my question is less about how could one make that assumption. I'm trying to figure. Your first argument is structural error.
It is.
Your second argument is not. I'm trying to figure out, let's just assume for purposes of argument to fit in for me what this deliberation, and maybe it's definitional. Maybe you think polling itself is deliberation. Let's assume they went out, 1 minute later they came back in, and everyone would think that's only enough time to ask 12 people yes or no. What does that do to your argument?
So actually, you're reminding me, I'm not actually addressing the specific question you had. How can the fact that they deliberated further be error? See, that's not actually my argument. My argument sticks with the fact that they were told that not only could they go and change their votes. See, at page 511, the judge used these words: you are done deliberating. That was said expressly to the jury when they were first brought out. But then they asked and were told, well, yes, you can still change your vote, which is deliberation, and two, that a different jury would decide it. Those are the errors I'm focusing on. I can't say that the fact that the jury went and,
Would your case fall apart if they didn't deliberate, if they came back 1 minute later?
No.
Your argument, okay, so it doesn't really matter.
It's based on the judge's instructions, because either way they went back into that room, whether they just sat there looking at each other for 20 minutes or not, knowing that, well, if we can't decide any of this, some other jury can. And that has to be seen as the most essential point of everything that followed after that. The reason that the defense attorney realized that the transcript from the motion hearing 2 weeks later was full of the defense lawyer saying, we talked about a scenario in chambers before they came out, and then what happened isn't what the judge said he was going to happen. There was no chance to consult, nothing. The judge just gave them the additional legal instructions and ordered a mistrial.
Counsel, can I just clarify, though, I've been looking again at the transcript of what the judge said before your client's attorney said they had an agreement, and the judge made reference to, I will not ask them to deliberate anymore, ask them if they've reached unanimous verdicts on any counts. And then previous to that, there was some reference to the, and this maybe goes to the previous day, it sounded like there was common understanding they may have some verdicts but not others. So my question is, it's after that when your client consented through counsel to unanimous or mistrial on all counts. So my question is, what different information would your client needed to have known to have decided to say something otherwise?
I'm out of time. Can I please go ahead and answer?
You may answer.
Well, first, I again need to distinguish this from Hunter, because as the judge just pointed out, when Mr. Lerma made that preliminary request for a mistrial, we didn't know what was going to happen yet. In Hunter, they did. On the second day of deliberations, they announced which counts they were unanimous on, which they were hung on, and they discussed it in chambers before they basically stuck to the plan of just rereading the instructions they were originally given. That was not done here. Neither things were done. No additional consultations, and the judge didn't simply reread the instructions. He told them exactly what Martin said he's not supposed to tell them. So that's the end. I'm distinguishing Hunter, and I'm saying that this was something that departed from the instructions, no consultation, which again, I'm going to rely on Kelly saying it must happen. The rule says notice, Kelly says consult. I'm out of time. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you both for your helpful argument. We really appreciate it. The briefing and arguments were well done, and that aids our decision process. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period.